You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Welcome to Counter Stories, a podcast by people of color, for people of color, and everyone else. I'm Anthony Galloway, Executive Director of Arts Us.
Donald Eubanks, faculty at Metropolitan State University and cultural consultant.
Luz Maria Frias, executive coach and diversity and inclusion leader and consultant.
Marianne Combs, reporter and producer at NPR News.
Halili, owner of the Other Media Group.
And even though you're hearing this on June 20th, the day after, we are celebrating Juneteenth this week. And we're actually recording this on the day of Juneteenth. You may be asking yourself, what is Juneteenth? And this is something that many folks have maybe never heard before. But in the African-American community, this is something that is very important. Just a history recap for y'all. In 1863, Abraham Lincoln signs the Emancipation Proclamation, really only covering the Confederate states. And if you're in a fight with somebody, it's kind of hard to make rules that they're going to follow. And as the message of the Emancipation Proclamation begins to move across the country and the Civil War is heading towards its end in 2 years, we have folks begin to move from slaveholding states over towards Texas in order to keep the practice of slavery going even after the end of the war. So much so that General Gordon Granger is sent and dispatched down south in order to forcefully, particularly the folks of Texas, emancipate their slaves. And he begins with this general order. The people of Texas, this is Gordon Granger speaking, are informed that in accordance with a proclamation from the executive of the United States, all slaves are free. This involves an absolute equality of personal rights and rights of property between former masters and slaves, and the connection heretofore existing between them becomes that between employer and hired labor. The freedmen are advised to remain quietly at their present homes and work for wages. They are informed that they will not be allowed to collect at military posts and that they will not be supported in idleness either there or elsewhere. Now, there's a lot in Gordon Granger's proclamation to unpack, but to the people and community of Texas, and then as it reverberated across the country, June 19th, Juneteenth, when this was read, becomes a moment to celebrate. And it launches itself into years later, family reunions, celebrations that started in Texas, but then move across the country with various levels of decline and resurgence. That is the history of Juneteenth. So now that it's Juneteenth, y'all, where are your heads at around all of these celebrations?
I listened to your quote of the general, and what I thought immediately was the fact that there were a quarter of a million enslaved people in Texas 2.5 years after the Emancipation Proclamation was announced, still toiling away under just unthinkable and inhumane conditions for no wages. And the other thought that comes to mind is the fact that for 89 years, the enslavement continued after the Independence Day of the United States. So mm-hmm. what we all see and believe to be July 4th as Independence Day, for 89 years, year after year after year, that enslaved people were not a part of that Independence Day, because they were not free. Mm-hmm. And that's the most prolific part of this, is when you read more and more into this, into the history, because we were not taught in school about Juneteenth. Mm-mm. And it wasn't until actually, quite honestly, as an adult myself that I learned about it, probably 30 years ago or so. But if you think about how little is known mainstream-wise, how little, if none, is ever taught in our school, and it's incumbent upon us then to learn independently, but how damaging, of course, this history is to our nation, to our people, to our community, to our African-American community in particular. This is a big disservice for it to continue to be under the radar.
Mm. Lee, you're about to jump in.
First, I was going to say, for listeners, if you go and Google Juneteenth and you want to learn more, there's a lot of articles and stuff out right now, like, oh, this is Juneteenth, right? Which is great. But a lot of the articles quote Granger up to a certain point.
Correct. They do not give the full.
They don't give the full statement where he says, you know, stay at home and be quiet and continue mm-hmm. to work there. You know, and so it sounds really great. So just so, like, you know, if you're going to go out and you're going to try to learn more, that's great. But understand that there is that context.
And it's bittersweet. This one of the things that you experience as a person of color in this society is that there is no pure moment of celebration that isn't buffered by the countering force and complexity and pessimism that also is there exists. Gordon Granger was forced to go give this proclamation. He did not want to. He felt it was beneath him that the head of the army has to go to Texas, except for the executive branch knew that the only way that this was going to carry any weight is if somebody very pretty high ranking went to deliver this proclamation.
Well, in the last couple of sentences that you read in his statement refer to no loitering around the outpost, and that won't be tolerated, which is a perfect segue to the practices to be ticketing and jailing African-Americans, particularly African-American boys and men, for things like vagrancy and loitering and things of that sort, to reintroduce the opportunity to have free labor for the white society that was so accustomed to it and it had really become so wealthy as a result of that.
I was just going to ask you, Anthony, I want to throw the question right back at you. Is that in talking about the celebration of Juneteenth, how have you been celebrating this week?
Absolutely. So there's a couple of things that come along with Juneteenth in terms of the practices there, right? So you have the first festivals and celebrations that happened right around the time and tried to get going, but it really didn't resurge and go forward until a little bit later when you started to have these kind of more organized festivals. But folks began to get together, and a lot of folks would have their family reunions right around the same time so that can coincide. On the day of, you have a lot of things that are red, cherry pies, red drinks, all those things to signify the blood of those who have gone before. You have a lot of practices around relinking. You know, we have a practice at the Center for the African Diaspora. We have our youth and they're educating them about Juneteenth. And we did an ancestral linking ceremony where we made a chain and we talked about regathering. There's a practice where you hold on to yourself and you go and you share and talk to folks about recorrecting. I got you. I have your back. I see you. And so those things. But then folks would dress up and there's barbecues and there's get-togethers. It is also a place where a lot of education happens. So when you talk about the last statement, the idleness and all those things, there are parts of Juneteenth celebrations that also pull together things that we need to know. How do we exist in a space post-slavery? I'm training as a minister in the African Methodist Episcopal Church, and the AME Church is a social justice body. Already had a split with the Methodist Church, and they began to hold and push forward Juneteenth education circles as that became a festival later. One of the things I find very interesting, however, is that the declines and the resurgence of Juneteenth tend to follow high and low points of race relations in the United States.
Mm.
You start to see a resurgence of Juneteenth celebrations. You saw some in the 80s around the pushback against some of Reagan's policies. And then it lulled in the 90s, came up a little bit in the Rodney King area. At one point in Minnesota, we had the second largest Juneteenth celebration in the country here at Theodore Worth Park for many years. And then as, you know, things seem to be going all right, we start to see a plateau. And then there was an incident one year outside of Juneteenth that folks falsely put on Juneteenth. And so the festival declined again. And now that Donald Trump is in office and you start to see some of the resurgence of white supremacist groups, we see another rise of Juneteenth celebrations. And this goes all the way through the patterns.
You know, and that fits because I knew we were going to talk about this. So I was racking my brain trying to remember exactly the first Juneteenth celebration I went to. And it was back in North Minneapolis.
Yep.
And so I was trying to think. I was either in my late teens, early 20s. It wasn't at Theodore Worth Park, however.
Nope.
I think, let me make a correction because I'm trying to remember exactly where we were at.
If it was the first one, it didn't start at Theodore Worth Park. It grew there, but it was bigger.
It was in North Minneapolis.
Correct.
And I was racking my brain trying to remember where we were at. Mm-hmm. I remember going to the Juneteenth celebration, not really understanding exactly what the celebration was about, and then getting there and then having people talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the very first time that I had heard, and I remember my reaction as a person of color. When you think about that, you think about the extraordinary means individuals took to move from Georgia, Virginia, or whatever, to bring their slaves to Texas, where the word hadn't been put out yet, and purposely keep people enslaved for an additional 2.5 years. You have to go out of your way and make extraordinary measures in order to do that. And, you know, we never talk about that side of this equation in terms of how hateful an individual do you have to be in order to keep people from their freedom when you know they've been free.
Well, it's a matter of that exploitation and manipulation of others, right? And a disregard completely for their humanity at the expense of these lives, for the exploitation of their free labor, and no accountability for that, right? So the slave owners, knowing that the Emancipation Proclamation had, in fact, been passed, and yet then circumventing that for their own financial gain.
Exactly.
It's really abhorrent.
Part of the things that make the celebration piece of it so huge is because in order to keep the lid on, because folks have this myth that information didn't travel. Slaves on plantations not only were connected to other folks, but think news traveled. And so there had to be a suppression of this news going forward. And so the celebration didn't come without an understanding of some of the brutal ways that things were set up to be for folks to be kept in. And what's interesting, each Juneteenth as we come up, the week is a celebration, but the celebration also is followed by conversations about life now. It's kind of like a ramp up of self-autonomy, because slaves were practicing and talking about, how do we do this ourselves? Nobody was going to give them money to do Juneteenth celebrations. And so we don't need or require the help of anybody else because it's not coming to us anyway.
Quick question. So why do we call it Juneteenth? If it's celebrated on the 19th, why isn't it June 19th?
So I just got to remind us about how language works for diasporic communities. There's not a one-to-one. Clea, you probably know this really well, that there's not a one-to-one connection. Yeah. There's not always a translation in there. And so we have what are called algorithmic or collective languages. And so if I can shorten something, June 19th, Juneteenth becomes Juneteenth. It's easy and it's not a big, huge thought process in order to make that happen. And it also, because of the significance of the day, there's no need in community to delineate why June 19th, not 13th, 14th, 15th, could all be Juneteenth. No, because we know that history in community.
I didn't know the history of Juneteenth until I was in high school. So I question why we were never taught this in our public schools. And if I wasn't involved in doing community organizing when I was in high school, and doing media work, I would never learn about it. I was working with some Black filmmakers and they're like, oh, let's all go to Juneteenth. And they were saying it like I should know it. And I felt super embarrassed. I was like, I'm on board. Let's totally do that. Just because I felt like, how do they know about this that I didn't? And so then when I learned about it, it really made me question what else I'm not learning in school.
It's that learning that is part and parcel to it. You know, our producer, our wonderful, awesome producer, got a chance to talk with Dr. Josie Johnson, our elder in the community, keeper of knowledge, keeper of education, all those things. And it's that education point that's part and parcel to it, because folks knew early on that there was going to be a need to understand the patterns that are happening now, because part of the practice is knowing your past so that you can know your future, this idea of Sankofa. And Dr. Johnson really gives us a really interesting space about the continual nature of having to understand these patterns, both past and present, given our current president. Let's take a listen.
Our freedoms have always been under threat. But what we are experiencing right now in this moment of history is a person, the president of the United States of America, feeling quite free to acknowledge his desire to keep us as a people enslaved and to ignore all of the freedoms that Black people and others have fought so long and so hard to achieve. When you look at the struggle for voter rights, for the right to assemble as we as a people can, for the right of quality health care, housing, education, protection of our children, all of those important elements of freedom are being challenged. And I think what is so disappointing for me is to realize how accepting some percent of our American population is very accepting of those denials, those withdrawals, those attitudes about us as a people. We're still the target of all kind of hatred and oppression. And it's being modeled right now in the open. It indicates that it's always been there, even though we've been successful in gaining some acts of freedom. It was deeply etched in the fabric of America, and all the people seem to need is to have someone like Trump, or who is declared the leader of our country, to feel free enough to bring forward all of that hatred for us as a people and the effort to continue to deny us the rights that are ours. So I'm very troubled by it. And at 88 years old, having worked long and hard for many of these rights that the president is now trying to deny, it's a very disappointing period for me as a Black elder in our society to see how fragile our freedoms are in the American society.
When I was looking through articles in preparation for our discussion, I ran into this really disturbing article by Antoinette Harrell that recounts her conversations with dozens of families in Louisiana that gave her proof that their families were enslaved into the 1960s, 100 years later. Their families were held to this debt, they're indebted to the plantation owner, and that for 100 years, the plantation owners and their families continue to kind of move the ball, you know, in a kind of a bait and switch situation where, irrespective of the hard work that those families were engaging in Louisiana and other southern states, that somehow they were never able to pay that debt, which is just unbelievable. So as we are sitting here talking about Juneteenth, it's heart-wrenching to read those accounts and to read the family names that were published with family members still recounting those stories of still being indebted for over 100 years after the fact.
And we should also talk about, you know, just because the proclamation happened and then What's-His-Face in Texas made a speech and stuff, like, it wasn't like people just, like, walked out the next day.
Well, like, in a lot of places they did, because they never trusted, particularly because of that last line that Gordon Granger says. I mean, to tell a former slave that to remain in place in an employer relationship, yeah, that wasn't flying for a whole lot of folks. So there was a mass exodus of folks happened.
There was.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But there were quite a few.
But there wasn't like a job waiting for them. It's not like how people, feel like there are people now who think like, oh, okay, I'm going to walk out. I'm just going to go to the town next door and get a job and a house and, you know, restart my life. Oh, this is so wonderful.
I often bring up the fact that my father, as an African-American male, fought in World War II, served in the Navy, and when on his release was denied access to the GI Bill. So it continues, like Luz pointed out, for African Americans in this country to be denied those opportunities, those equal opportunities. It didn't end with emancipation. It didn't end with Juneteenth. There were no jobs. I mean, you're free, but you're free in a country that it just enslaved you for the past 200 years. And they're going to just turn around and hire you and pay you now? I don't think so. I read that full account of the general's message. It's hard to read that. And then, of course, later, during Reconstruction and Jim Crow, you know, Southerners passed those laws and bills, essentially arresting young black men and boys for idleness.
And vagrancy for not having a job, exactly, for stealing defense posts, I mean, for loitering, and, for all
and,
these
and
things.
And they're not going to hire you, so they turn around and arrest you for not being hireable. I mean, just think of the psychology of that. I mean, you know, so it just angers me. You know, Dr. Johnson, you know, put a lot of stuff out there. And the image that was coming to my mind, I remember Trump early on in his presidency, in his Oval Office, when he was meeting with some Native American tribal leaders.
Yep.
And he purposely had pulled out an old portrait of Andrew
Jackson,
which had been archived, right? And for folks who may contextually may not understand the significance of that, is Andrew Jackson supported slavery and also is the president who signed the Indian Removal Act, removing all the remaining tribes in the Eastern Seaboard under pressure from the states, because the tribes owned huge. The Cherokee tribe owned most of North and South Carolina, including Georgia, was their land. And it angered the states. And so Jackson signed that Indian Removal Act, resulting in removing all those tribes to Oklahoma, and it, which we now refer to as the Trail of
Trail of Tears.
But to be meeting with tribal leaders and then purposely putting that portrait of Andrew Jackson in the office where he met with tribal leaders, you know, the fact that he praised Andrew Jackson, he saw him as a role model, sent a loud, clear message, I think, to many of us in our communities, exactly where this guy was coming from.
You speak to one of the tenets of Afrocentric thought, and that is Sankofa, looking at who we were, who we are, and who we want to be, and the specificity of the cycles of history. The Trail of Tears example connects directly with what Dr. Johnson was saying about the rights that we continue to move for. She actually used the term slavery, because slavery in community is not just the physical state, but also the control that was exerted in multiple ways outside of that, all connect for that education part of it. But, you know, the fact that you can look at Juneteenth experience and make a connection to the forced removal under the Treaty of Echota that Andrew Jackson put forward, which, by the way, was a treaty in agreement with a tribal leader, not the head, the elected head of the Cherokee. They bypassed the who won in Supreme Court.
Right.
And so, you know, all of that specificity of that history, you know, tees up that regardless of where you come from, emancipation and the celebration of real emancipation is something that connects to multiple identities. This is something that was raised by Lee Jordan, the Minnesota organizer for the National Juneteenth festivities. And here's what he had to say.
The reason why you look back at history is so that you can see the paths that were taken, but also can see what steps were taken to make sure that we either moved up or eliminated or whatever. So looking at history gives you a chance to go, wait a minute, that sounds awfully familiar. There's something about what someone's trying to do that has been done before or tried before. You see that movement and you think to yourself, I have the strength like someone else did to say that's not right. And it has to stop, and it has to stop now, because we, the people, have the power. To me, that's a strong part of what Juneteenth is. These people realize now that they were freed. Some of them just got up and just left things behind, didn't care. You know, but they were freed. They just left, because at that point in time, they had that idea that my life belongs to me. That is what we as Americans have to understand, that your life and your power, that is for you to find how to move forward in that and make sure that no one takes your power away, no matter who they are. And to me, that's another part of Juneteenth. That's, as I say, that's my radical voice speaking about Juneteenth. Yeah, and because I do want to make sure that people understand that it's not some hatred movement of, you know, it's a black thing and you wouldn't understand it. Because freedom has no color. Yeah. Freedom has no race. Freedom has no sexuality. Yeah. Freedom is freedom. And that's what Juneteenth is.
Why do we have to preface when we talk about our independence, we talk about our humanity. We talk about our lives mattering, and we have to contextualize it and say our radical self. It just blows me away that as Native Americans, as African Americans, as different communities, ethnic groups in this country, the things that this administration is doing to Mexican and Mexican Americans. Mm. And when we stand up and talk for our freedoms, for the liberties that are supposedly explained in the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, and yet, you know, we have to preface that by saying my radical self. That's not being radical. That's just pointing out the inhumanity that some of our white neighbors continue to oppress and suppress us. And
I, as somebody who did not learn about Juneteenth until I was an adult, until I moved to St. Paul, for me, the thing that I've come to really appreciate is that it's not just an African-American holiday, that this is something that we should all be celebrating, the whole idea that your liberation is tied up with my own. This is about our nation getting better. This is about a move that took us forward as a people. We're not done yet. It was one step, but we have to celebrate what we can.
Well, Frederick Douglass said the Republic Party, as it was, often does wrong by choice and right by necessity. You know, mm-hmm. And Republic Party, contextually for the time frame he was in, but his statement was generalized to all society. But, you know, when you think about the radical nature of it, it is radical. Every single autonomous movement, and particularly in the African-American community, for autonomous freedoms has been met with the vehement and measured and direct opposition by white supremacist voices from Tulsa, Oklahoma, to the riots that happened with folks who tried to leave the plantation, to the induction of the Ku Klux Klan, to the resistance and the putting up of Confederate monuments, not early in early days, but in response to moves for freedoms, in addition to the assassinations and community beatings and all of those things. So I just want to say that freedom and declarations of freedom is absolutely a radical move.
So, Marianne, you mentioned just before the break the word holiday, and while Juneteenth has been recognized in at least 45 states across the country and in D.C., it's not yet a federal holiday. It's not federally recognized, you know, in terms of the federal offices being closed and businesses and families being able to take the time off from work. When you stop to ask yourself or ourselves collectively as a nation, why not? Why not? There is this monumental time in our history when we know that 4 million enslaved people have been freed, quite honestly, through the 13th Amendment, not necessarily the Emancipation Proclamation, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. 13th Amendment, really in December of 1865. Why is our country still not ready to make that a federal holiday? And if you think about the importance of it in making sure that the recognition and awareness is universal, you know, nationally across the country, so that children and adults now recognize the importance of that. But it also will force a conversation, I would hope, and I would offer for our families to talk. But in order for us to heal as a nation, that we need to address that truth and reconciliation. We need as a country to own up to our history, own up to our original sin, own up to the fact that if we continue to ignore the importance of this and the trauma faced by millions and generations of African Americans in our country, we are not positioned to be able to heal. And if we as a nation continue to ignore that, but yet validate and recognize other atrocities in our country as recently as, you know, 9/11, and it's an atrocity that we all recognize, and we recognize the trauma there, why are we not yet moving forward on this?
I love you so much, Luz. You know, why isn't voting day a federal holiday? We all get off work. Is everything is used to suppress, right? I mean, the people with the power don't really want to give that sort of celebration and celebratory and happy and community building, honestly, in communities of color is not good for those who are decision makers.
They're not ready to admit it.
Yes. It did take our black mayor to declare yesterday, as you're listening to this on the radio, Juneteenth Day. And so hopefully our state will follow suit.
And it took President Obama to give it a national day of remembrance, not necessarily a national holiday, because that would require something different. Quite frankly, they didn't have the power to be able to do in terms of a national holiday. Again, it's all of our history is juxtaposed with another counterpiece that complicates the whole thing, because even though 45 states have recognized, Minnesota was the fourth state to recognize Juneteenth in some form, there are no states that have it as an official holiday where there are state designated offices closed and things like that. But there are states who still celebrate Confederate Remembrance Day with state offices being closed and things like that. So, you know, no matter where you go, your history is also always juxtaposed. And our youth are not unconnected to that. I interviewed youth at our center as we learned about Juneteenth. And there's a couple of students who struggled. The first we'll talk about is Kamathi, who talked about the complexity of even learning about Juneteenth in the context of his own family.
Like a day to me, like where the slaves were actually officially released. So like if that didn't happen for me or my dad, I wouldn't be able to be who I am today or like have my dad or any of them. Cause like back then they weren't allowed to like have sex with white people or be married or have like, I guess relationships with white people.
And so you come from a mixed family. Your dad's black, your mom's white. And so have you had conversations about Juneteenth and what it means at home?
Not really. I like just learned it yesterday. I think my dad might know what it is, but I haven't really asked him if he knows what that is.
One of the things that he would go on to say, because as we were talking, the rest of the youth leaders are sitting there and there's folks who had known about Juneteenth before. Kamathi comes from a multiracial family. And one of the things he talked about was, you know, there's definitely a juxtaposition between part of the family who knows about Juneteenth and part of the family who celebrates 4th of July. Now he's talking about how do I go back and merge those things together, because we're still going to do 4th of July stuff. But he talked about encountering folks in his family who are going to be like, well, OK, that's nice. But 4th of July is what we do and we're going to put our energy to.
Do you find that maybe it's because of the topic of just slavery? It makes people so uncomfortable when you start talking about that topic. When we learn about it in school and we talk about it, a lot of the white kids in class would be like, that was generations ago. And so it's something that they just don't even want to acknowledge had existed. At the same time, ignoring it is like, quote unquote, rewriting or erasing our history. Like when people get mad about the Confederate statues being taken down.
It's not rewriting history, but ignoring it allows it to continue. And so I think that gets into this denial. And it keeps the system in place. Our schools do not educate about anything that really happened in this country. So it keeps individuals at a certain level of understanding. So when you think about who benefited from slavery and juxtapose that and think in terms of the economic inequality that exists in this country now, and many of those families gained that wealth through slavery, and it's generational. Mm-hmm. And so when you think about that, you think about that, the income inequality that exists now across the board for all of us. I mean, those folks have left us in the dust.
And one of the things that the kids brought up in there, I was looking for, just to be completely honest, I was looking for some of the statements that Trump has made that would definitely make the kids respond. What they responded to wasn't the direct statements. What they responded to was the pattern of omission. They equate the omission of the experiences of people of color as continuation of white supremacy. Mm. And that was an aha moment for some of the white students in the group here at this Afrocentric Learning Group, who began to now look at that and go, wait, so if I don't keep these stories going, then I'm contributing. And so they've completely shifted the stance where, and I'm excited that Friday we're going to have a multiracial group of students all celebrating Black emancipation. Like, that's a huge thing. But that omission, that omission was what the students were most incensed about. And I thought that was very interesting, because there are definitely some statements that were made that I thought would garner that response.
You talk omission. What about just straight up ignorance? Some folks who are listening to this show right now are probably going, wow, I've never even heard of Juneteenth.
Well, isn't that the byproduct of omission, right, is the ignorant.
And we say this a lot. It's so, not our job to educate.
According to the students, particularly white students, however, in our group, that is not an excuse.
Well, and we think about the intentionality of our leaders to omit this segment of our history completely. And then the media as a co-conspirator in that regard, where the media has spent little to any time really recognizing the importance of Juneteenth. And Hali, you mentioned earlier there are all these articles. I agree. This year in particular, mm-hmm, on social media, it was more the social media-based type of news segments rather than your mainstream broadcasting segments that really have spent time and energy on this. But I think about how a quote that I learned many years ago that says, every system is intrinsically designed to render the results it's intended to get, which goes to Don's point that this is no coincidence that we continue to be in this pattern, that it is a pattern of white centrality in terms of benefits and gain and power in terms of wealth and financial inequities and disparities and inequalities. And you juxtapose that with other countries who have had similar patterns of oppression, and they've figured out different ways to begin to come to reconciliation. You know, I mentioned this a number of years ago when we were doing a similar segment, where Australia every year as a nation apologizes to its indigenous people for the oppression that they endured at the hands of Australia. We look at the country of Japan that, in terms of education inequality that you referenced earlier, where they actually will invest as a country more money as a government in low-income schools and low-income neighborhoods so that they are empowered to rise above and out of poverty. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure that out. That
it goes back to the people who have the power to make these decisions want that.
And it's not hard. It is not that difficult, I should say, for us as a country to remedy those situations that this country created at the backs of millions of people and generations of people, and that we still need to rectify.
Can we just get, like, you know, on calendars, and they always put, like, well, this is Christmas Day, and this is the day you celebrate Kwanzaa. And so can we just get Juneteenth on calendars, at least?
I have a calendar with Juneteenth on it, just saying.
That comes with Juneteenth on the calendar.
That comes with Juneteenth on the calendar, but black folks made it.
You know, and your students, you know, by omission, I know that
Harriet Tubman cannot be
will
on
not
the,
be on the $20 mm-hmm. bill.
Mm-hmm. Replacing Andrew Jackson. Mm-hmm. Keeping Andrew Jackson, I should say.
So the same group of students that Kamathi was a part of, there were a lot of things that came out. But in the conversation, one of the things that came out was, you know, as we were talking about the examples of white supremacy and all that, they said, well, what's up with the Confederate flag? Mm-hmm. So we get into a conversation about the Confederate flag, and 2 seconds into the conversation, the kids are like, well, there's a Confederate flag on the house just right up the street. And all of a sudden, me and Chantel Allen, my husband of Twin Cities and does a lot of community activism work, both me and her look at each other. And she's like, yep, actually. And she gives me the address where it's at. And the kids knew it. And then the kids began to name addresses where they see Confederate flags in the windows all around us. So this idea that we are not distant from. And the kids' immediate response after they were talking about it and that reality came in was a complete shift. And they said, all right, that's great. I want to talk about all that racist stuff on a different day. But I feel like it's Juneteenth and I want to celebrate. And I want to party. I want to celebrate all the beauty of us in that space. And this is something that's always a tension around Juneteenth, because we'll get into conversations about all the other folks and all the other stuff that's going on that is seeking to recreate some of these conditions that we were fleeing in the first place. Then there's always a point, and I've had every single year in Juneteenth, there's always a point where we go down the walk of all of the white supremacy and some racism around us, and then somebody's like, yeah, that's all well and good. That's going to be there tomorrow. Right now, I want to come back to celebrating us.
This is our moment.
And that's a tension that's always been there as long as I've celebrated Juneteenth with family. And then there's the piece of so many folks at the same center for the African diaspora who are coming into the space of going, I haven't really taught my kids as much as I think I should. So there's this conviction that also comes every Juneteenth, which how well did I do instructing my kids? that we have so many kids in our center who are only hearing about Juneteenth because they're at an Afrocentric program.
Well, imagine if Sesame Street would begin to teach it. You know, imagine if the other children's programs that are on PBS or any other major, you know, Cartoon Network, where children are exposed to that. You know, imagine if in our different documentaries that are coming up, imagine if someone took the lead to do that. It's all possible, and none of it is difficult. But where do we continue to spend our time in ignoring that, and not by accident, but by intentionality?
I posted on Facebook today, Happy Juneteenth, and you know, you can choose like little backgrounds to put. I couldn't find anything, so I put flowers. But that's, I mean, it's just even little things like that, that just to help folks recognize that this is something that's happening, I think could be. And I'm going to write to Facebook and be like, you should have it. Google.
Yeah. Dr. Gates has done some wonderful stuff.
Henry Louis Gates.
Yes. I mean, as a historian, as an academician, the things he has done, he just did a whole thing on Reconstruction. But he also has done one on Juneteenth. As I was preparing, in fact, it was his stuff that I pulled
maybe
up.
Maybe Ken Burns can do something. People, like, yeah. Pay attention.
I have to say that I'm just going to say, yeah, at one point, an earlier version of me would have said, so if I want to celebrate Juneteenth, what should I do? I have learned better than to ask you how I should celebrate. So I'm just going to put it out there that I am going to celebrate Juneteenth. And some of the things I was brainstorming, okay, how would I celebrate it? How could I, as a white person, celebrate it? And I was like, well, I could watch 13th by Ava DuVernay. I could go see a show.
I'm sorry. I'm chuckling just because that's great. It's deep and all that. But Juneteenth is a celebration.
It's a celebration. Well,
I don't watch 13th and get a celebratory mood out of that one.
Well, yes.
So, okay. Yes, still watch 13th. Don't get me wrong. Please still watch 13th. And
learn how to play
something
spades.
Red and having barbecue just sounds a little weird to me as celebrating Juneteenth
good.
As a white person.
Good.
That
good.
Feels
I appreciate
weird.
That. Okay. I really do appreciate
grill some ribs and learn how to play spades.
I'll work on that too. But the idea that there are tons of black businesses in town that I could go frequent.
Absolutely.
There are amazing, there's an amazing, the Penumbra Theater Company. There are young black artists who are doing incredible work in town. I could go see one of their shows.
Absolutely.
So there are so many different ways that I could celebrate that would support the black community.
And that has been something that actually has been practiced a lot, using Juneteenth as a day of financial liberation, of going and patronizing. Yes, all those things, absolutely. I would offer also, as we think about celebrating Juneteenth, to remember why folks celebrated in the first place, right? It wasn't just the news of emancipation, right? It was a living of the example of emancipation. Folks would do things that were markers of emancipation. They would dress to the nines. They would come and do things that very specifically that you could not do, at least not do without interruption. Now, remember that interruption came after these first expressions, that was with cycle of resurgence of Juneteenth that continues.
Didn't have barbecue,
but I just want to keep that in the mind, you know. Of, I mean, we ate good.
And in Texas, there were some black leaders who actually, as a community, pulled all their money together and bought 10 acres of land to establish a park.
Correct.
That park became kind of the greeting place and the milestone for a community. And these are all acts that otherwise would not have been allowed to occur and have taken the narrative from being enslaved to one of empowerment.
Absolutely.
And one of then self-determination and courage. And being able then to redefine your identity from a place of power rather than one of submission.
And remember, it's a place of learning too. So remembering that it's also a place where education happens. There are speakers that come in during Juneteenth. The first time I ever heard Elder Mahmoud speak was at a Juneteenth celebration. And so that education piece is a part of it. So I was being facetious with 13th to make sure that you got some celebration and revelry in there.
Absolutely.
Because there are a whole lot of folks who fought, and you know, General Granger going down there was a multiracial coalition of folks putting pressure on our executive branch. So all of those things have to be in the mix as well. My concern, if we don't do that, is then my kids, I'm just thinking about my kids alone, if they don't get the celebration and the education all at the same time, then this holiday becomes something to dread rather than something to really look forward to, mm-hmm. and you get some information. So mm-hmm. so that's a balance that I always want to make sure stays in my household.
Absolutely.
Well, I'll leave you with this. Langston Hughes said it best when you're thinking about Juneteenth. I, too, sing America. They send me to eat in the kitchen when company comes. But I laugh, and I eat well, and I grow strong. Tomorrow, I'll be at the table when company comes. And they'll never say to me, eat in the kitchen then. Besides, they'll see how beautiful I am and be ashamed. I, too, am America. This is Counter Stories. I'm Anthony Galloway.
Don Eubanks.
Luz Maria Frias.
Marianne Combs.
Halili.
And we'll see you next time.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to the conversation, you can call in at 651-227-6000 or tweet us at Angela Davis NPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. You can send us your questions or comments by emailing talk@npr.org.